playback on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Dublin Airport's Platinum VIP Terminal. Experience private check-in, suites for relaxation, and then chauffeur-driven to your aircraft.
Good morning. Put away the biscuit tins, plug back in the exercise machines, and let me take you through some of the week's radio between the years. On Morning Ireland, reporter Aaron McElroy spoke to students at Ashbourne Educate Together National School about how different cultures rang in the new year.
It's a rule, we have to stay until 12 o'clock. This is a tradition because my parents are from Moldova and we usually, my mom buys like a lot of oranges and we usually eat them and have lots of fun eating them.
What's fun about eating an orange?
No, because like we have to try to eat as many as we can.
And how many can you eat?
I don't know. My mom usually buys like a bucket and at the end of the day, probably like half of the bucket is gone.
We watch the countdown on TV and we have a real big dinner on it. New Year's, we have a roast chicken. My mom likes stuffs this thing inside the chicken every now and again. She would like, she'd put a ring. And whoever like finds the ring is like the winner of it.
We usually have a big meal. Baked fish, we also have potatoes, sometimes kebabs, and also like a Russian salad. In a Russian tradition, we, like my grandma, she gives us like gifts for New Year.
I normally go over to friends' houses and then we watch movies and have like a very big dinner. And with that, I'd have beetroot soup with a type of dumpling called pierogi, which is just a type of dumpling in Polish culture. And after we're done eating, we'd normally open presents. And if I'm staying at home, I'd wait until midnight to call my grandma because it's her birthday on New Year's Day.
Also on Morning Ireland, reporter Sheila Nocton met with some residents of the Curlogue Nursing Home in Wexford and asked whether or not resolutions are a good thing.
I'm Bernie McKay, 80.
John Bowen Curry, 90.
Sis Murphy, 95.
Francis Keelty, and I'm 78.
This is me, I'm 92.
Michael Murphy, I am 73.
I'm Eileen, I'm 100 and I forget how much more.
The voices and singing of some of the residents of Curlogue Nursing Home in Wexford as they get ready to say goodbye to 2025 and hello to 2026. Before we spent New Year posting pictures of our festive charcuterie boards on social media and hear from our friends at Curlogue about how they once spent New Year's.
I used to love coming, going down the Halfpenny Bridge, as they call it in Dublin. I used to love going with Mammy and hear them all yabbing. But my sister was always the one there for polishing and cleaning. So I did nothing, only go with Mam, do the shopping.
You know, it was that wonderful in Ireland at that time, the 50s. But put candle in a window and everything was dolled up for the occasion and a baby who was spree.
We always got New Year's turkey. But New Year's was just as important as Christmas Day because we're facing the unknown, celebrated very spiritually.
It's all the family you get around in the house, Lisa. When I was younger now, Lisa, I'd be the youngest in the family, so it'd be great, like, to have everybody coming home.
New Year's resolutions have spanned the generations, but are they a useful tool for goal setting or just things you realise you haven't done at the end of the year? Well, it's back to Wexford to find out.
I don't make New Year's resolutions because I would never ever keep them. So I just don't bother.
Yeah. I'm a bit too old for to be making things like that.
Giving up sweets and chocolates and all.
Did you stick to it?
Not really.
Best-selling author Miriam Hussey was on Reignite with Áine Kerr and asked some fundamental questions about how we can live a better life this year.
What do we really want in life? And I think it would be safe to say that most people would say, I just want to feel at ease.
And in order to get to the point of ease and happiness and contentment, the one real thing that we can do for ourselves is try to reduce the stress. If we could do that, it just has these multiple cascading effects that are good and healthy in our lives.
Absolutely. And it's not to say that we totally eliminate stress, because not all stress is bad. We absolutely need a certain amount of stress to, you know, give us that injection of adrenaline and cortisol to get up and get out and, you know, go after those goals. That is needed and necessary. Where it becomes destructive is if we live too long in what we call the sympathetic state dominant part of the nervous system. So we have two main parts, sympathetic and parasympathetic. So I think about it as the red zone and the green zone. The nervous system was always meant to be like a light switch. The light goes on, so it's there to protect you. If a bear jumps out of the woods, you get this injection of adrenaline and cortisol, so you can either fight the bear or run away to keep you safe. However, the light switch is always meant to be turned off then. And we go into the green zone, and this is where you rest, digest and repair. But often in this kind of always modern go, go, go world, we're not switching the light switch off enough. We're like the athlete who never gets off the track. So what I'd be saying to people, the biggest thing we can do for our health, well-being, our performance and our clarity is to help regulate that nervous system regularly. How can we, it's like an elastic band, you pull it and then you let it come back. You fracture, you repair. So how do we get into the green zone? And one of the most important, simple, most powerful ways that we can do that is the breath. We all have a pair of lungs. We can do it anywhere, at any time. It doesn't cost anything. But when we do it regularly, it allows us to regulate that nervous system.
Oh, that feels better. Now, one thing that may not help with stress levels is looking at your bank balance this week. How many days left to payday? Claire Brock was standing in for David McCullough, and she spoke to Kaz Mooney, who's undertaken serious financial trimming in her own life. She told Claire how you can begin to claw back some of your regretful spending.
So all the non-essential subscriptions, cancel them, because at the click of a button, you can get it back again if you miss it. So one of the first things we did when we were trying to save money was cancel absolutely everything. And then anything we missed after about a week, we could look about bringing back and maybe start off again with the basic package.
Yeah, I can imagine that if I said cancel all the subscriptions in our house today, getting back to basics is a good way of understanding what you need. Is that what you did, because you had to confront your own debt?
Yeah, so we did what we called a low spend year. So for 1 year, we cut back all unnecessary spending. And the reason why we did that was because we wanted to clear our debt, but we also wanted to buy our own home. And we just couldn't see how that was possible without making a big change to our finances. So we did a low spend year. We cut back all the non-essentials for 1 year. And we really started to learn about our finances and take control of our money. We realized we were having our money control us, and we were living paycheck to paycheck, and we were living for that paycheck, essentially, especially that last week of the month where you're really waiting for the paycheck to hit. And instead, we started to take control so that we were preparing for each paycheck and we had a plan.
There's something you refer to as lifestyle creep.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, so basically that's where your lifestyle starts to cost a little bit more over time as your wages increase, as your lifestyle increases. So in our family, we went from one income to two incomes. And that's where we started to see lifestyle creep, because we suddenly had a whole lot more money in our budget. And we just started to spend it. We were going on holidays we couldn't afford, and we were spending money we just didn't have. And it happens so gradually that you just don't expect it to happen. It just kind of creeps up on you.
And maybe you want to clear the head thinking about your lifestyle creep, or you just want to start the new year on the right foot or the right 2 feet. John G. O'Dwyer, a man who's walked many parts of Ireland, was on to give Claire some walking tips.
The great thing about walking is, I mean, if you decide tomorrow morning, and they're great sports, I've no doubt about it, but tennis or golf, before you can enjoy it and play a respectable game, you probably need coaching, you need, you know, racket, set of clubs, everything else. With walking, you can just take it up. Now, when I started off walking first, it wasn't as easy, because really it was all about mountains, and you had to be able to navigate, and you went up the high mountains, and that was it. So it was a kind of a rarefied breed of people that did that. But now what you have is you've over 1,000 low-level walks all up on Discover Ireland. You don't have to complete them fully. And the great thing is, you do need the skills you're talking about if you're going up Carron Tuathail, if you're going up Errigal. But you don't need them for these low-level walks. They are what you call waymark, which there means there are arrows to tell you where to go all along the way. So I would say to anyone, you know, you can't just start playing tennis immediately. Just get right out this afternoon, find your nearest walk and pick an easy one and start off, and it'll be a gift that will keep on giving.
Now, speaking of hills and coming alive, a special lyric, Movies and Musicals, paid tribute to Julie Andrews. See what I did there? Replaying parts of an interview with Aideen Gormley, who asked Andrews about not getting a particular film role. This was her considered reply.
Well, I know this is a question you're often asked, but I just think you're very gracious about not landing the role of Eliza in the screen version of My Fair Lady, which went to Audrey Hepburn. Surely you must have been disappointed, though.
You know, at the time, yeah, of course, I probably was disappointed, but I completely and totally understood it. I was still only known on Broadway. Audrey was a huge international star. And in those days, that's how those movies were done. They didn't pull the little girl from the ranks of the company and put her on stage, put her on film. So it was understood, and it was disappointing, particularly in later years. In retrospect, I wished I had put the role down or committed it to film or television or something for maybe my family's sake, my children's, grandchildren's sake, but it never happened. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, along comes Walt Disney, who did want new talent, fresh talent, and asked me to do Mary Poppins. So how could I bitch or be unhappy when those kind of incredible slices of good fortune were coming my way?
Brian O'Connell here. Now, while the release of State Papers had some fascinating insights into geopolitical events of the mid-1990s, it was also reassuring to know that aside from church-state relations, securing peace and dealing with NASA, government and diplomatic representatives were also dealing with the tricky issue of securing tickets.
Today's files, USA 94.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I know you're a big football fan, Gavin, like myself. So when I think about USA 94 and Ray Hampton's goal against Italy in particular, it's images of happy-go-lucky fans in America that spring to mind. But diplomats, they privately told a slightly different story in these files. One file we've published this morning in the past couple of hours shows that while Ireland was celebrating, hundreds of Cork-based Irish fans were in a far less happy mood when they got to Orlando in Florida. Now, that's because while they were travelling, the British travel agent SportX went bust, meaning those fans were left without hotels or tickets for the second game against Mexico when they landed. Now, that was no laughing matter, with Ireland's Washington embassy writing in December 1994 that officials believed at the time the situation could turn, in their words, riotous, and that a riotous situation was only narrowly avoided when quick-thinking diplomatic staff either gave up their own tickets of their own volition or found, let's say, some creative ways to resolve the ticketing dilemma.
Talk about putting them under pressure. And it wasn't just sporting events that had officials preoccupied, as Evelyn O'Rourke told the News at One.
Well, in a case of the more things change, the more they stay the same, Evelyn, the never-ending quest for U2 tickets made it into the official government files. In this case, it seems the Department of Foreign Affairs was really looking forward to getting very good seats during the Joshua Tree tour.
Yes, papers they confirm that we've been looking for tickets for U2 for nearly 40 years at this point. This goes back to a document to the files where U2's manager, Paul McGuinness, had lunch with officials from the Department of Foreign Affairs. They had what was described as a useful conversation where they discussed possible mutual cooperation towards the benefit of Ireland's image abroad, because of course U2 were storming America at the time, so this was a good thing. And part of this new relationship between the band and officials from the DFA meant that a selection of much sought after tickets for the nearly 80 gigs across America would be on offer, with the reference that U2 would gladly make available a certain number, this is key, in the document, brackets 50 to 60 of backstage tickets for the ambassadors or different diplomats. Now, never have brackets done more heavy lifting, because later correspondence shows that officials may have been a little over-enthusiastic in their invitation and guest list, with one clarification the file suggesting that the number 50 to 60 was across a number of dates in each city and not per concert. So then a text in the files confirms the band was offering 10 tickets per show because they couldn't handle the larger number. This response then was sent from an Irish official based in America, stating that the limit of these has put us in an embarrassing situation. But a response from HQ a few days later says, "You will appreciate that there is little that can be done about U-turn by the band in this matter. Why not ask your contact if you could put more than 10 per night on your list if situation is embarrassing?"
Bowman Sunday continued exploring the beginning of wireless broadcasting to mark the centenary of the opening of 2RN. And John Bowman opened his programme with a fascinating audio snapshot of what was and was not deemed appropriate on the early wireless.
From the beginning, the politicians were ambivalent
about it.
But they allowed this cursory thing called broadcasting in there.
Into the GPO.
And they kept it there for many, many years and couldn't get broadcasting out.
The politicians starved radio.
In the library at that time, we had no shelving.
There was no recording equipment of any sort.
The fee that was given was very small.
We didn't do it entirely just for the guineas, you know. We did it because we liked it.
And there were culture wars about music policy. For many years, crooning remained a matter of disdain for some.
But as for crooning, I think it's flaccid, emasculate, and almost positively indecent.
There were some firm opinions indeed on what would not be suited for broadcasting on the news station.
Robert Brennan said flatly, no jazz on Radio Éireann.
To manage all of this responsibility was the director of broadcasting, Seamus Clandillon. His job description was best captured by Geraldine Neeson in Cork, who witnessed at first hand what was expected of her husband, Sean Neeson, the director of the Cork station, 6CK, which opened the following year.
He arranged programmes, engaged artists, made announcements, ran gramophone recitals, held auditions, sang a group of songs when the occasion demanded, and conducted the orchestra.
This was expected of Clandillon too. He sang on 2RM. Clandillon's mailbag reflected the fact, then being learned for the first time, that when it came to broadcasting, you could not please all of the people all of the time.
And I, for one, very much look forward to Director General Kevin Barker singing us a song or two in 2026. On the News at One, presented by Cian McCormack, Dimitri O'Donnell also included John Bowman in his report on the 100th anniversary.
The centenary of public service broadcasting in the country has been marked in a series of special programmes and events across RTE throughout the year. Dimitri O'Donnell reports.
This execution of the dole in more of the field area.
This recording is of Douglas Hyde, later Ireland's first president, one of the first voices heard on 2RN. Hyde delivered the fledgling state's first public radio address in Irish and English at 7:45 p.m. on the 1st of January 1926.
The idea in 1926 was to start a station that would become the voice of the nation.
Dr. Rosemary Day is an associate professor at Mary Immaculate College and author of On the Air, 100 Years of Irish Radio. She says Douglas Hyde set out his vision for what radio should accomplish for the nation.
He said that it was time for Ireland to take her place amongst the nations of the world. He wanted Ireland to be modern and contemporary, and every other European nation had started their own radio station, so Ireland was a little bit later.
2RN was not fully endorsed by the establishment at the time of its birth.
Politicians called it a hurdy-gurdy. They thought it was only a bit of nonsense, and they were much more concerned with building houses, getting people out of tenements, trying to stem the tide of emigration. There was terrible poverty in Ireland. There was terrible lack of education, lack of good health care. It was a very, very different country. This was the first time that people could turn something on in their own kitchen or in their own sitting room and actually hear a voice that was telling them what was happening that day.
But there will be local coastal fog and drizzle in the west and north.
From those first crackling transmissions, 2RN gradually grew in popularity as the service expanded. Broadcaster and historian John Bowman said the service had a very slow start initially.
It was quite difficult to establish radio because people didn't have electricity, there weren't that number of sets in the country. It was quite episodic in its way, and it was, people were dipping into it when they could catch it, and because they were actually trying to capture it because they hadn't got very good sets. The reception wasn't very good. There were all sorts of difficulties. And it was finally driven by technology. The big changes in radio came with tape recording, really. And that didn't happen until really the 40s, late 40s, and then the 50s.
Also reflecting on 100 years of radio was Marty Morrissey on his New Year's Day programme with a panel of guests including Kevin Doyle, Barbara Scully and Siobhan Ní Ruaraigh.
It is 100 years of radio this morning, Marty, and they chose you to be the voice of that historic occasion.
You're booked for February now as well, OK?
And here we are carrying on the tradition. Yeah, and look, some of the reflections in the paper. I actually much prefer radio to television, always have. And I know you talk about podcasting maybe as the evolution of radio in some ways, but it's a much more intimate and immediate kind of way of communicating.
Best medium of them all, Kevin, in my humble opinion. And I love radio.
I think people on radio, and Marty, actually, you do a lot of TV and radio. I think people are more real on the radio than they ever can be on TV, because you've all those cameras, you've people standing around you. Whereas on radio, it's like a little bit like going into someone's living room and chatting away and talking. And you see that in some of the coverage today, talking about the influence of people like Marion Finucane and Gay Byrne, and even all the way back to Micheál O'Hare, who was kind of the first celebrity and kind of laid the path for you, Marty, I suppose, in some way, in making GAA is synonymous with, you know, Sunday, turning on the radio, hearing the match. Those kind of things that they were 100 years old and they're as relevant today, even though people say media has changed in lots of ways, but we still turn on the radio to hear the match on a Sunday.
Radio helped to change Ireland and open doors and open perspectives. Would you agree with that? Would that be a fair assessment? It's played a huge role.
I think so. And you know what? It's a kind of a safe space because it's in the kitchen. It's in your kitchen.
Yeah.
So you're often listening to the radio on your own, but you don't feel on your own because you're hearing these voices that reflect your view of the world, or at least a view of the world that maybe challenges you. So I think it is that idea that it's in the car where you're on your own. It's in the kitchen where you're on your own. So actually, when people are debating these kind of topics, you're actually able to decide for yourself without the pressure of what your husband might think or your brother or sister or friends might think. You're there on your own taking it in.
And then you get to go and discuss it with everyone who's also listened to it as well, you know. Yeah. So it does create a community and connection in that way as well. It's beautiful.
Yeah. And you're doing a podcast now, aren't you?
I am. I'm doing a pregnancy podcast at the moment, Marty, called Labour of Love. Yeah, diving into all the nitty gritty and what you need to know about pregnancy.
And we must say congratulations.
Thank you very much.
When is the baby due?
So I'm actually 37 weeks today. So, but we're still looking at about 3 to 5 weeks, depending on how punctual baby is.
Okay.
Yeah.
January baby, so.
Fingers crossed. Great for the GAA, I've heard.
Yeah.
Well, we wish you all the happiness in the world.
Thank you very much.
And indeed, thank you for calling the baby Marty. I really do.
Or Martina. We don't know
Martina,
what it means,
Marty, yes.
You'll settle for either.
I settle for either.
Yeah.
And I'm your godfather as well. There's no problem. Special race in the month of January.
You heard it here, folks, first.
Marty, godfather for hire Morrissey there. Now, the time between turkey and fireworks also allowed space for some new presenting voices on Radio 1, although they're not necessarily unknown voices. Mark Feely, who's taken time out from Westlife, made a welcome return to music by presenting an Icons programme on Wednesday, Thursday and Friday this week. He began by paying tribute to Nina Simone and setting her music in social and political context.
She had a habit of taking songs that already existed and reinventing them in her own incomparable style. Now, a lot of things in Nina's career, it would seem, were unintentional. This next song was originally recorded as an album filler in 1957. Now, little did she know that 30 years later, a Chanel No. 5 advert in 1987 would introduce her and this song to an entirely new generation. This is Nina Simone, My Baby Just Cares For Me. Mississippi Goddamn is one of her clearest statements. She wrote it after a series of deeply tragic events in the South, moments that shook her and the entire country in the United States, and she answered them with a song that was brave, uncompromising and full of truth. It's more than a performance, it's Nina Simone standing up and refusing to stay quiet.
Noel Tumbu is a Congolese-born guitarist who's been living in Ireland for 20 years. And on Tuesday he presented an hour-long show on some of the guitarists that have helped influence him. Not alone did he present the programme, but he brought along his guitar also, setting the bar for multitasking presenting even higher. Now, where did I put my tin whistle? Here he is talking about a very personal memory.
This song means a lot to me, emotionally really gets me, because I have a memory of my childhood where we're walking with my mother, going back home from somewhere, I don't know, I was maybe 5 or 6. We didn't have money for transport, so I have a memory of my mother begging, just people on the street trying to find money so we could get home. And that song, it would have been around that, you know, in June, because around June, you hear that song everywhere. So that's, I have a memory of walking with my mother, she's begging, and that song just blaring everywhere. So it really gets me. Yeah, so that's a bit of a sad story there, but the music still, you know, keeps me strong, gives me a lot of positivity in life. In fact, all this music that I'm playing, you know, it was like a sanctuary, you know, listening to this music just sheltered me from all that harshness of Kinshasa. I'm going to explain a little bit about the Congolese guitar that you heard there. Basically, he was playing. And today you will hear very, very melodic and rhythmic guitar at the same time in Congolese guitar, like. But then later on, you know, it got mixed with a lot of, today you would hear a lot of intervals, like. So you can say, I'm playing two strings at a time, instead of just one string. So I'm playing more. Could also the Franco would have more, he would use more six, like.
Fantastic playing, Noel, but stop giving management ideas, please. Back shortly. Have a listen to this.
He's an Open champion, he's a PGA champion, he's a US Open champion, and he's a Masters champion. And he's one of only six men who can say that. And it's taken him 11 attempts. And my goodness me, he did it in the most tortuous way you can imagine, in the most Rory McIlroy way you can imagine. But he's done it, and still he's choking and sucking in the Augusta air.
Last year was the year Rory McIlroy reached the promised land, becoming the sixth golfer in history to win all four majors, as well as winning the Irish Open and helping Europe lift the Ryder Cup. Good luck to him trying to come up with some realistic New Year's resolutions this year. Rory McIlroy's Hollywood ending, broadcast on Tuesday, documented his rise from a kid starting out in Hollywood County Down, where coach Maureen Medill, herself a former tour player, remembered what a teenage Rory was like.
I first set eyes on him when he was 15, and I was working for the BBC at the Forest of Arden, and he got an invitation through Darren Clark into this European tour event. So it was a practice day and very mucky, Forest of Arden, and I wandered down to the practice ground, which was exceptionally narrow. And here was this curly-headed lad in white trousers, mud coming halfway up the calves. And he arrived on the practice ground and sort of elbowed his way in between the likes of Thomas Bjorn and Darren Clark on this very narrow practice ground. And I thought, my goodness, he's got a bit of a nerve. He's got some swagger about him. The mop of curly hair, he looked like the springs of a burst sofa, sprung out of his head, and he started hitting the ball. And that was my first sight of Rory in the flesh. I mean, there was a frisson of excitement from all the people around on that pro-am day at the Forest of Arden all those years ago. And I think he was 15, and it was only the following year I was working at St Andrews at the Open, and word came through that this young lad had shot 61 round Portrush in the north of Ireland in the qualifying for the North of Ireland Championship. And I honestly thought it was a mistake. I thought, well, he's left out the last two holes. And I was just keeping my fingers crossed. And, you know, it's been a great, great thrill to follow his career.
Former rugby player Donica O'Callaghan was on with Bernard Dunn to talk about the psychology and personal thought process behind high-level sport. It was a fascinating conversation, and it landed on something deeper, a sense of togetherness instilled in Donica after his father died when he was just 6 years old, and also on leaders that inspired him.
they have to walk the walk. None of them ever had hollow words, and they led in everything. Like, I just use Paul O'Connell for an example. He was so easy to follow because he was setting the way himself. You know what I mean? You never had to question his performance. I miss the collective. I miss the mob. I miss the group. I miss the tribe really badly. And do you know what I miss them for? Whatever about crack and fun, you can have that with your own mates. And it is great in the dressing room. It is. It's alive and similar people with similar views, and just it's immature because there's such highs, you have to bring it down, you know? But what I miss is the brutal honesty that if you're not good at something, I will tell you, because I know this sounds a bit corny, but that I love and care for you so much that I would tell you your blind spot, as opposed to, I've noticed that in other industries and other things I've gone into since, everyone tells you what you want to hear. No one actually grabs the nettle and goes, do you know what? You're awful at that. And if you don't improve, we're all in trouble. Your family don't really get it. It's only the people that are in the room get it.
Speaking about family, and I suppose that has to come from somewhere. Growing up in Cork, losing your father at such a young age. And
absolutely. I must say, like, rugby was so formative in kind of creating me. I know that sounds a bit sad, but just shaping me completely. And you're right, my dad passed away when I was six. And I'll never forget it. And it's always been the drive. It was my mom. My mom, straight away, I remember her. I remember the morning my dad passed away. I remember her calling us in and honestly saying, here we go now. Like, everyone's looking for us to fall down. Everyone's looking. She nearly created this nearly environment of it's us against everyone. And we're not going to drop the ball. I've got you. I've 100% got you. But we need to catch each other as well. And I remember she, within that environment, she created this kind of drive to always have each other's back, always push each other on. She was kind of ruthless as well when it came to the kind of sports side of it. She'd be like, don't back down. I remember, like, even small lines, you go playing against New Zealand and you can play against, you know, against the aura. You know what I mean? The mindset of what they've done. And she's there, no, stick your chin out, man. You know what I mean? Same bones in their ass as you. I don't know, now that I have kids myself, I don't know where she found that strength at all. I'm there like, oh my God, for that time to be like so ahead and so...
So strong.
So strong, yeah. And honestly, I actually always find it with leadership that you follow. What you tell me, I'm not great with that, but I can follow leaders.
If they show the example.
Show the way, and she always did.
Also reflecting on life and loss this week was comedian Aoife Dunn, whose stand-up show, Good Grief, deals with the passing of her mum aged just 53. Aoife spoke to Marty Morrissey about how her show came about.
It's the weirdest thing. I don't know if you want to believe in divine intervention, but I was in Tenerife in August 2023, and I was with my boyfriend at the time, and John hates the sun and heat, and I told him, no, let's go to Tenerife because they have just a temperate climate. And he was like, are you sure? I was like, I swear, it's 20 degrees every day. And then we got
there. And it was 28.
No, it was nearly 40, Marty. It was the first time in, like, record history. And he was looking at me, he was like, you said. And obviously none of the Airbnbs, nowhere has air conditioning because they don't need it.
Yeah.
And then we were, like, baking sweat. So we pulled the mattress out onto the balcony in the middle of the night, and he was, like, so mad at me, and we weren't talking. And we couldn't sleep. And then it was like an electricity bolt hit my soul. I burst out of bed and I was like, John. He's like, what? I was like, I'm going to write a show and I'm going to call it Good Grief. And I'm going to write about what it took me to understand grief and how your life is still beautiful no matter what way it looks. And even if it wasn't the life you had imagined. And I'm going to help people. And he was like, right, how are you going to do that? I was like, I have no idea. But in 2 years' time, I'm going to go to Edinburgh with this show. And I had no idea where I was going to start. But the next day, we were walking around a shopping mall trying to find a hat for my giant head. I don't know if you've noticed this, Marcia.
No, it's a lovely head.
There's a lot of head behind the head. And John, because we were only 6 months together and I was still trying to be, like, you know, cool and sexy. Yeah, and I was like, oh, and then, you know, eventually none of the hats were fitting. He was like, you really have a massive head. So I was like, ended up in the man section, like, looking for a giant head. And then I couldn't find a hat for my giant head in Spain. And I stormed off, embarrassed, and I ended up in the children's section. And I screamed because on a T-shirt, I saw the words, in Spain, good grief.
Wow.
How weird is that?
That is weird.
And then John came running over. He's like, what? Did you find a hat for your massive head? I was like, look. And he hates all this stuff. Like, he's not woo-woo or anything. And he was like, that is so weird. I was like, John, it's my mom. I have to do this. And like, I've never kept a promise, Marty, to myself. Like I told you, I have kept my life mid. But in that moment, I was like, I made sure that everything I did was to take my show to Edinburgh, no matter like what way it looked. And I did take the show to Edinburgh this year.
Now, a bit of hush, please. Sure 'Twas Better featured a programme called Around the Christmas Fire from late December 1980, where a panel included Ben Kiley and Maeve Benchy. They reviewed a book called Tom Corkery's Dublin, which documented singing etiquette in some Dublin pubs. Good luck trying this in Temple Bar. The Sure 'Twas Better panel of Paulie McGlynn, Jules Call and Emer MacLysett responded.
There are a few exceptions to the rule of no singing in pubs, and he lists them. He says the visitors might like to note them down. He says, A, if you are a member of a wedding party that has been celebrating all afternoon in the same pub, or if you can attach yourself to such a party, which is by no means a difficult feat, then you can sing. Or if you are in town celebrating Christmas Eve, that's okay, but not in most pubs for some strange reason, New Year's Eve. You can't celebrate that by singing. Or if you are a Welshman in Dublin in the week preceding or the week following a Welsh-Irish rugby international. Or if you are an emigrant just returned from the land of the stranger. Now, I think, you know, from my sort of large-ish knowledge of pubs, I think that's a very good set of rules. And it was very funny to see them all written down.
I really enjoyed those pub rules, I have to say.
They were brilliant.
About the singing being allowed and when you're... I love the idea of a Welshman being granted the piece to sing for the week before or after
an immigrant
a rugby match.
Returned from the land of the stranger.
Yeah, brilliant. Or if you've been part of a it's wedding, just like, but join in. Wedding crash.
Yeah. But the idea of a good pint house, which is always, to this very day, what anyone would want. And I'm not necessarily a pint drinker, but my goodness, I salute the good pint house where it is enough to manifest oneself at the counter and they know what you want.
Will Hannafin's series also featured archive from Marion's Christmas, presented by the late Marion Finucane in 1997. And it featured seasonal memories of celebrities such as Maureen Potter and one DJ Carey.
Joining me is all-star DJ Carey. Now, I was told that you had some very early encouragement in your chosen sport from Santa.
That's right, Marion, yes.
What happened?
Well, I was about 4 years of age and I got a hurl and a ball and a pair of boots and a helmet for Christmas. And I still have the helmet to this day. That's a fairly famous story now. I still wear it. It's battered and it's held together with a bit of insulation tape and the foam has half gone inside and there's all sorts of bits of blood and hair and everything on it. But I hope it'll finish my career out now. I've grown into it a little bit, but it's nice and tight now and it has a firm place on the head, we'll say.
Well, an interesting listen considering the more recent fall from grace.
Do you know, and I just got worried at the very beginning when he was talking about Santa and thought, did he scam Santa too? But, you know, the glory days
the same thing.
And the mighty have fallen.
Like, is this true? Oh, 4 years old from Santa? Oh, really?
Really? In a more festive spirit, I did see, and I'm sure maybe lots of little people got them from Santa this year. You can get a little thing in a box, a Herlogue with a tiny little schlitter, and you can get them personalised.
No!
It's just like, oh God, the little size of them.
I've got to buy them.
They're so cute.
But when was everything not enough? Oh, I found that a really difficult listen. It obviously in increments things just got away from DJ Carey.
The Navvies was a term applied originally to workers who went to England in the 19th century to build the canal system and later on to develop a new world in exile with crack and music in great pubs like The Favourite and Archway. Jim O'Donoghue Martin's programme The Navvies of North London featured ex-Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn.
They worked all over the country. They were given a very bad reputation by the newspapers of the day, like the Sun later on. as being drunk, disorderly, criminals, etc., etc., and also allegations that there were fights between navvies of different nationalities, because some navvies were English from different parts of the country, some were Scottish, some were Europeans, and so on. So it's important that we correct that historical image. These were very hard-working men who did it because they had no choice, because of land laws in Ireland, because of poverty in Ireland, and so much else. And I think they should be acknowledged and respected. There ought to be some more said about the origins of the music experience of Holloway Road, because the Irish music there was phenomenal. English folk music of the, particularly the late 18th, 19th century, must have been heavily influenced by Irish, particularly Irish navvies, in English towns. You think of it, building something like London to Leicester Railway, take random, Melton Mowbray, town like that, isolated then, quite conservative English town, would have had probably a few thousand navvies living there to build the railway. They'd have been there for a few years while they're building that section of it. They would have had a huge influence on the local community. And the traditional drinking songs of English pubs would then have become influenced by Irish songs. And so Irish music had that effect on English folk music, and vice versa.
As 2025 ended, Oliver Callan gave the year a good kicking in Callan's Kicks New Year's Eve special, which satirically recreated some of the year's big political moments, including a certain White House meeting.
And then the big day arrived. Me, the Taoiseach of Cork.
The tetchy Taoiseach himself.
In front of the most powerful man in the world.
The crankiest man meets the creepiest. What a time to be alive.
It was my highlight of the year, gone hours. I'm very uncomfortable now. Do I look too pasty next to the President? Have I said thank you enough times? Thank you, thank you.
I want to say I love Ireland, but I hate the EU.
Oh, Jesus.
Evil EU.
I'm saying nothing.
But Ireland, tremendous, tremendous. I've got a great golf course in Dunbeg.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Everybody knows Dunbeg.
The roads are terrible. I'll fix the roads, Mr. President. We're all about roads now. Do you want a bypass? I can do
I've had a few, believe me. And my doctor says it's all the Big Macs from Mickey D's. You got Mickey D's?
No. Mickey D isn't here. The Irish president has no power at all. He's just ceremonial, like the women in cabinet.
But I gotta say, Dunbeg, terrific success, despite the EU. Horrible, nasty people in the EU.
Let me ignore that. No, I love Dunbeg too. Great views of the storms, smashing Clare to bits. Smashing.
You see, that's why I'm trying to build a wall.
Oh, I'll get the OPW to throw up a wall for you. Anything you want to do.
You look like you're about to throw up, you know.
God, this chair's uncomfortable. Me chakra can't settle at all.
But Ireland, of course, has stolen many of our companies. They've done a great job. Stolen our companies.
Well, in terms of on a point of the Ryanair AerCap.
What are you talking about?
Let me squirm a little bit here. I love Israel. Did I say that yet? Israel?
As I was saying, stupid leaders there that Ireland steal
in terms
our companies. A Viagra companies, which we needed. We get nothing back from these guys, although, to be fair, we did give you Rosie O'Donnell. You know her? Bad deal. Bad deal.
Who's she now? Ah, feck, this wasn't in the notes at all.
You're lucky. You're lucky you don't know her.
Aramis chakra's in bits now altogether. The only way this could be any worse is if someone mentioned
Conor McGregor, the greatest Irishman ever. Ever. Unbelievable.
God, I should have brought a change of underwear, mother and lord, why didn't they stick to the teaching?
Last weekend's Sunday with Miriam was a collection of some of the standout musical guests over the past year. And one of them, Cork's Mick Flannery, was asked about his family. Till next time.
I have three kids, 16, 3.5 and 9 months.
9 months. Wow. Is the baby a boy or a girl?
Girl.
Does she sleep?
She sleeps sometimes. It's up to her. She's in control of everything that we do.
Absolutely. Yeah. But when I was listening to you singing there, that first song, it's almost like a lullaby. Do you sing her to sleep?
I used to sing songs to my son, but I was told to stop because I was choosing. I used to sing Kilkelly Ireland to him. Do you know that song?
No, have a go.
It's like six verses long. All these letters of a father to an emigrated son in America. It's the saddest song you'll ever imagine. And even though my son wouldn't have understood what the content was, my brothers told me I was psychologically torturing him by just giving him this. deep famine misery every night before he fell asleep.
So you had to stop it.
Yeah, yeah. So I just walked him around in silence.